Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, in for Tanzina Vega. This is The Takeaway, and we start the show today with some big news out of the FDA. On Monday, the FDA approved a new drug to treat Alzheimer's disease, the first in nearly two decades. It's called aducanumab, and it aims to slow the cognitive decline often associated with the disease. Mary Carrillo from the nonprofit Alzheimer's Association said this about the drug.
This is the first FDA drug approval that delays decline due to Alzheimer's disease, which means that individuals may have more time to actively participate in activities and to have sustained independence, hold on to their memories longer.
Plainly, the Alzheimer's Association and other groups are celebrating the decision. And certainly, the FDA's decision is expected to have far-reaching implications for patients, providers, caregivers, and so many others. But already there is fierce debate over whether or not the new drug even works. Now, my family's group text lit up with excited and worried messages as soon as news of the new drug was released. Alzheimer's is a constant theme in my family, just as it is for so many others, with more than 6 million people in the U.S. living with the disease today. And for Black families like mine, grieving during what has been called the long goodbye is complicated by the fear that medical racism will prevent our elders from receiving the best care. So while many members of our family are enthusiastic about the possibilities of this new drug, others are concerned that it could widen the already deep racial healthcare disparities that mark the experience of Alzheimer's disease. For more on the new Alzheimer's drug and what it could mean, we're joined by Jennifer Manley, a professor at the Taub Institute for Research in Aging and Alzheimer's Disease at Columbia University in the Department of Neurology. Jennifer, it's lovely to have you here.
Hi, Melissa. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. And also with us is Pam Bellick, who is health and science writer at the New York Times. Pam, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Melissa. It's great to be here.
So, Pam, let's start with you. Just how significant is the news of this new drug?
This is very significant. It is the first drug for Alzheimer's that's been approved in 18 years, and it is the first that goes after a key part of Alzheimer's biology, a protein called amyloid, which is the protein that clumps into plaques in the brains of people with Alzheimer's. So it is a very big deal to have this. There is a lot of controversy, as you said, about whether it works, and there are going to be a lot of implications for which patients are going to be eligible. The FDA was not clear. They didn't narrow that down. So I think there will be even more of a flood of interest in this, and clinics are going to have to manage that, and they're going to have to figure out how they're going to screen patients, and they're going to have, you know, enough infusion centers. This is an infusion, an intravenous infusion that patients will get once a month. And they will also need to get regular brain MRIs to check for a potentially serious complication, which is brain swelling or brain bleeding. So this is really going to shake up just about everything in the Alzheimer's landscape.
So, Jennifer, let me come to you. I hear Pam talking about these potentially very challenging side effects, these concerns over the drug's efficacy. And yet, the last time we saw a new Alzheimer's treatment was way back in 2003. So there is still some level of enthusiasm, again, even in my own family, that we were feeling about this yesterday. But why did it take so long to get another medication?
Right. So I think that's, part of the concern here is that there actually have been a number of amyloid clearing drugs that have come to trials over the past several years, but those drugs were not shown, just like this one, aducanumab, were not shown to improve the cognitive symptoms of Alzheimer's disease over those people who had placebo in the trial. So just to be clear, this drug approval yesterday, if you read carefully the FDA documentation, was to clear amyloid from the brain, but not to treat the symptoms of Alzheimer's disease, which are cognitive impairment and dementia. And so, you know, the FDA has directed Biogen, the maker of the drug, to perform additional trials to determine its efficacy in preventing decline. So one reason why it's taken so long to develop these drugs is that we're targeting a protein, and this drug and others do a great job of taking it out of the brain, but it's not so clear whether this helps improve cognition.
So thank you, Pam, so much. That's so helpful for understanding sort of what's at stake here. And it makes me want to step back just a little bit, Jennifer, and to ask you then, what is it that we know about Alzheimer's and about what causes maybe less that question of the proteins, but those cognitive impairments, those things that take our loved ones from us little by little. What do we know about that?
Right. So that's the key question. You know, for me, I try to understand why those cognitive problems, those that loss of memory, confusion, and the other changes that families see and people living with dementia experience. I try to figure out why that burdens some populations, some communities more than others. Very much like COVID and other diseases, Alzheimer's disease is experienced more often disproportionately by Black and Latinx or Hispanic families. So there's something about our our social and structural environments that raise risk for cognitive decline in Alzheimer's disease. For a long time, we have known that amyloid and tau, which are two proteins that aggregate abnormally in the brain, are part of Alzheimer's disease, but there's increasing evidence that the cognitive symptoms associated with Alzheimer's disease are also linked to cardiovascular and risk and cerebrovascular disease. So, changes in the brain that happen because of the blood vessels and the vascular system in the brain. This drug does not treat those, those vascular changes. So I think we're coming as a field to a realization that the neuropathology of Alzheimer's disease is more complicated than we thought before.
And Pam, despite these deep complications that Jennifer is laying out for us here, there is still so much enthusiasm about this. And is that about kind of the desperation so many of us feel for any treatment at this point?
Yes, I think so. I mean, this is, this is a very serious disease. Obviously, it's very widespread, 6 million in the United States, 30 million worldwide. As our population is aging rapidly, that's going to probably double in the next, 30 years. So there is a desperation for treatment. I'd like to say, I agree with everything that Jennifer has said here and explained. And I think it's really important to kind of counterbalance the enthusiasm for, some new approved drug with expectations for, what it might or might not be able to do. This was a drug that, as Jennifer said, there's a long history, I think 25 years worth of clinical trials of drugs that have successfully, you know, lowered the levels of this amyloid protein and yet not shown any effect at all, any benefit at all on the memory and thinking problems that characterize Alzheimer's. This one was, there were two clinical trials that were essentially identical that were conducted with this drug. They were both stopped early because a safety monitoring committee said, this doesn't look like it's working. And so about more than a third of the patients who were trial participants didn't actually complete the trial. So you have a smaller amount of data than you expected. And then one of those trials didn't show any benefit at all. The other one showed in one dose, in the high dose, really a very slight benefit. And we're talking about perhaps slowing decline of memory and thinking problems by maybe 4 months over 18 months, or about 2.5 months in a year. So while on the one hand you have, you know, the patient population and the family population totally understandably saying, well, any kind of delay in decline could be meaningful. On the other hand, you have the scientific community in large part saying, this evidence isn't convincing. Even the FDA kind of said, this evidence isn't really that convincing. That's why we're asking for another trial. And even if it was convincing, the potential is pretty slight for benefit and may not outweigh the risks. And I guess one other thing that I wanted to say, and Jennifer mentioned, you know, the clinical trial that the FDA is requiring Biogen to do to confirm, you know, whether or not they get the same degree of benefit in that trial. That's because the evidence wasn't convincing. But the thing with a clinical trial is that that's going to take probably 4 or 5 years. And so while that trial is running and trying to recruit patients who will participate, which is hard to do in Alzheimer's trials as it is, this drug is available for, you know, a number of years when we don't really have a conclusive answer.
So Pam, let's talk more about these questions of racial disparities relative to Alzheimer's. Help me to understand if this is, as we sometimes see in health disparities, truly along the lines of race, or if this seems to be actually race standing in for a variety of socioeconomic status questions. Which one does this look like from your research?
I think, you know, Jennifer may be better placed to answer that. There certainly is a disparate effect, and populations from, you know, BIPOC communities are disproportionately at risk for Alzheimer's. And I think there's a variety of reasons for that. They also, unfortunately, have disproportionate access to care and to memory clinics. And interestingly, you know, in these clinical trials, which are, as I mentioned, it's really hard to recruit patients to participate to begin with, the participant base tends to be overwhelmingly white, at least in this country. They usually do have, participants from many other countries, but this is a problem that we've seen in many clinical trials for many different diseases. You don't get a good representation of the United States population. So whatever effect you're seeing in the drug may not generalize to the entire population.
I can add to that a little bit. I think just going from what Pam was saying about the trials, we know that only about 1% of participants in Alzheimer's disease clinical trials identify as Black, and about 3.4% only identify as Hispanic or Latino. So this is no different in the trial that we're talking about right now. I think that the primary concern about this is some of those side effects that were mentioned before by Pam, the brain swelling and brain bleeding. Those side effects impacted about 35% in terms of the brain swelling, and about 17% had brain bleeding. And because so few people from my community and your community, Melissa, participated in these trials, we don't know what the frequency of those side effects would be in those groups. I think the other big deal here is that overall, Alzheimer's disease is an underdiagnosed condition. Only about half of the people in the U.S. who have Alzheimer's disease dementia ever receive a formal diagnosis by their doctors. And this is even lower, significantly lower among African Americans and Hispanic people. And so, you know, the diagnosis and the identification is a part of why, you know, we have concerns about access to this drug and access to treatment. You know, my research shows that there are life course social and structural risks that increase the risk for Alzheimer's disease and dementia, and that these are modifiable because we have ways in our country of investing in neighborhoods and investing in schools and investing in healthcare among people who wouldn't normally have the opportunity to get that. And so just from a population or public health perspective, my focus has been on increasing access to diagnosis, increasing the utility of the tools that we use to diagnose, and also trying to find out why we have these disparities in dementia.
So Jennifer, tell me if I'm overstating this. Are you suggesting that Alzheimer's, like diabetes, like asthma, like maternal and infant mortality, is in part a result of structural and systemic racism, as well as these kinds of plaques on the brain or other physiological characteristics?
Yes. Well, though structural and systemic racism are the fundamental causes of some of the disproportionate investment in education, for example. So what we're finding is that schools that serve Black children have less, investment, federal and state investment, and that we can trace by following people over the course of their lives in these big national studies, we can trace that level of investment to their risk for dementia and cognitive impairment later in life. So absolutely, like COVID, like diabetes, like hypertension, there are these links to racism that need to get explored. Now, that doesn't mean that the disease itself is different. Right. In terms of the neuropathology, that means that there are other ways to modify the disease.
Pam, can you give me some hope? Are there other medications in trial that might be even more promising than this one that we're just seeing approval on?
Yes, actually, there are two medications that also attack amyloid and seem to do a better job of that, actually. And they have had more promising results from their sort of mid-stage trial, their phase two trials, and they're now in the larger phase three trials.
Pam Belloc is a health and science writer at the New York Times, and Jennifer Manley is an associate professor at the Taub Institute for Research in Aging and Alzheimer's at Columbia University. Thank you both.
Thank you, Melissa.
Thanks for having me.
Now, we've been talking about the new drug approved by the FDA for treatment of Alzheimer's. And with more than 6 million Americans living with Alzheimer's, this news is personal to so many families, including mine. For the past 2 years, my big sister has provided round-the-clock care and companionship for her mother, who we all call Nana.
Nana's Alzheimer's advanced swiftly during the pandemic. And while I only live a few blocks away, COVID-19 meant I couldn't provide much help. I spoke to my sister and she told me what the hardest part of last year was for her and Nana.
As difficult as it was not having home health care, the most difficult part was not being able to take her out. So because you're concerned about them losing their ability to walk, you want them walking every single day. And we would take her like to Walmart or to the mall and just walk.
Mm-hmm.
And she would associate getting in that car with going to someplace. And your daddy used to always take her out to eat pre-COVID. And then all of a sudden that comes to an end and she doesn't understand why.
We asked you to share your experiences with us. And here's what you had to say.
Your question was about Alzheimer's. And I could share with you that our wonderfully bright mom, at the age of 90, she was a 26-year elected councilwoman, got to spend the last 4 months waking every morning and asking us, why am I sleeping downstairs? What's going on? And we got to tell her for the first time each day that she had incurable brain cancer. And then watch her take in that difficult news with total surprise and dismay. This Alzheimer's is a cruel disease, and its cure deserves a relentless pursuit. This is Greg Keenan from Stamford, Connecticut.
Our biggest emotional challenge caring for our mother with dementia is constantly listening to what we call her mantra, this particular loop she's stuck on, which is, what am I doing? Tell me what to do. Our friend's mom with dementia has her own loop, which is, why am I here? It would be interesting to predict what your loop might someday be. This is Jackie from Green Bay, California.
This is Karen from Forest Park, Oklahoma. I once worked as an unskilled caretaker for a woman with Alzheimer's. It was really sad to see how just lost she felt in her day. It's a totally brutal disease, and I am optimistic about future treatments because the alternative isn't bearable.
Hi, this is Sue Leone from Raleigh, North Carolina. Alzheimer's is shitty. There is no other way to describe it. Prevention or cure, great. But in my opinion, treatment just prolongs the agony for everyone.
Hi, this is Barbara Anderson. I live in Brownsville, Oregon. I'm 67 years old and have generations of Alzheimer's victims on both sides of my family. So I'm really counting on effective treatments being found before I start feeling its effects. It's a fear I live with. It's a brutal disease for both the sufferer and those who care for them. I've been through it many times with people I love dearly. I'm counting on the scientists.
Hi, this is Mary from Philadelphia. I suspect that I may have the early stages of Alzheimer's disease. I'm 77, and my sense of smell is not nearly what it once was. And in the past 2 years, I find that I'm being more forgetful. As far as cures or treatment for Alzheimer's, I don't see that happening in my lifetime, although we may learn more about prevention and the causes of Alzheimer's. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Todd, and I'm calling from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. My wife's aunt lived with us for 10 years. After she was diagnosed with Alzheimer's. You know, my wife was her only caretaker until she was placed on hospice. We got no help from family or friends, financially or otherwise, as far as helping out my wife to give her a break or anything of that nature. My wife actually ended up having to stop working to stay home and care for her. And she did pass away at our house at 90 years of age. You know, both my kids, you know, were minors at the time. It was dramatic. Traumatic and difficult, but I think on the back end, my wife felt obligated and not so much enjoyed taking care of her aunt, but felt like it was her duty to do so. rather than put her in a rehab facility.
Hi, this is Elizabeth from Napa, California. My mother died of Alzheimer's last year. Her father died of Alzheimer's 25 years before that. And I'm terrified of the disease. I am really interested in this new drug. I will check it out. And I'm also interested in a death with dignity law for people with Alzheimer's. Because right now, even though the disease is fatal, once you have Alzheimer's, you're not considered competent to make the decision to end your own life. So it's devastating for families, it's devastating for finances, and it's not a great quality of life for people at their end of life. That's my opinion about it. Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Thank you so much, as always, for sharing your thoughts with us. The number to call is 877-869-8253. You can also always send us a voice memo to takeawaycallers@gmail.com.
They shoot journalists on sight in the Capitol. They literally see us as enemy combatants.
In the new movie Civil War, the United States is up in flames, and the truth teller is just another casualty.
The movie is using journalism as a lens to show you what happens when social trust breaks down completely.
On this week's On the Media from WNYC. Find On the Media wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, in for Tenzina Vega. In April, the recipe website Epicurious announced that they would no longer be publishing new recipes that use beef. They cited beef's environmental impact and the greenhouse gas emissions associated with raising livestock as their reasoning. Not long after the Epicurious announcement, 11 Madison Park, a New York-based Michelin-starred restaurant, announced they would stop serving animal products, again, pointing to sustainability. The announcements were met with mixed reactions, and it reignited conversations about the role and responsibilities of individual consumers for battling climate change. In the U.S., where meat is often the centerpiece of our meals, and where, according to the USDA, the average American eats 222 pounds of poultry and red meat each year as of 2018, reducing or removing meat from our diets can feel like a big hurdle. Joining me now is Alicia Kennedy, a food writer and author of the newsletter From the Desk of Alicia Kennedy. Alicia, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you so much for having me, Melissa.
Talk to me about how significant the decision was for Epicurious to decide to no longer publish beef recipes.
It is a hugely significant decision in the food media landscape where meat is still really, really prominent, you know, as well as shrimp, as well as fish. You know, there's no kind of move in the broad food media toward saying, hey, that there is a problem with the amount of meat and animal products that we consume in the United States. There's very much a sense that we have to say that it's okay to eat as much beef or as much chicken as you want. We have to say that it's okay to, you know, get these products anywhere, you know, not go to your local butcher, not make sure the rancher is using sustainable practices. You know, it's very much a hedonistic type of approach to eating and consuming meat especially. And so when Epicurious made this decision, they really broke with the food media kind of unspoken rule that you don't tell people that anything is bad about something that we eat.
So let's talk a little bit about what are the problems around meat consumption. And I think for a lot of folks, they think about either vegetarianism or veganism or even reduction of meat consumption, either around like a personal health question, so reasons that it might not be, quote, good for you, and then this more collective question of why it might not be good for us as a species, as a planet. So can you maybe say a little bit about both?
Sure. Well, the food system globally accounts for 1/3 of greenhouse gas emissions. And so that encompasses lots of different things. That's not just meat, but beef specifically accounts for 14.5% of that. And so a lot of that is maybe not specifically the practices of beef or that sort of thing. But in total, how the way we produce, the way we process, the way we transfer and transport beef accounts for 14.5%. And so that's a big chunk of those emissions. And it's also, yes, this place where we can make a personal choice to reduce or give up consumption of this product totally because of its impact. And personal choice, of course, is a tricky subject because we want to talk about, you know, really getting at those corporations who are responsible for, you know, massive amounts of greenhouse gas emissions. We don't want to say it's all of our personal problem that has caused global warming. But at the same time, we can make these smaller choices in our day-to-day lives that make a difference and recognize, you know, the big impact of what we eat on climate change. And in terms of beef consumption, it's especially important because of that big number. And also, you know, if we were going to kind of change the way we produce and process beef, if we were going to stop subsidizing industrial meat and dairy and the factory farms, we would have to change how we consume. We would have to probably lower that amount of meat we're eating every year from 222 pounds, you know, going to have to drastically reduce that. And that would be kind of a natural progression if we did change regulations. So it's a very tricky subject because it is about all of us, but it's also about how we all respond to, you know, this knowledge and also the fact that the government does subsidize those industrial beef and dairy for $38 billion a year. And so it's not it's not all about our personal decisions. It is about the regulations and it is about the government. And, you know, that money is making the cost of meat artificially low in the supermarkets. It's not accounting for the workers who are often, you know, not paid properly, they haven't been attended to properly during the COVID-19 pandemic. I believe 59,000 meat processing workers came down with COVID-19. And it's these places where they are situated, these factory farms, they're going to have runoff that is going to have environmentally detrimental impacts on people who live in those areas. So it's a really big issue, but at the same time, one of the only ways we have to combat it is to say, I'm not going to eat meat if I don't know where it's coming from.
It's almost as though in the complexity of your answer and the swiftness of it, we're starting to capture some of the complicated realities in our food system. I mean, those subsidies also impact farmers, but farmers aren't always who we think they are. They are also farm workers who are not the same folks who own the land. All of these questions. And then it comes down to, what am I having on Tuesday? Or does meatless Monday make a difference? Or that long-term practice in Catholic traditions of fish on Fridays? Do those individual choices make a difference? Or do we need big institutions like colleges or these other folks who feed a lot of people on any given day? Does it have to happen at that institutional level? Or can we make a difference on our own family plate?
Well, I think that institutional level, of course, would be huge. It would be such a massive impact on the ways people eat. And of course, that would also be a very angering decision, I'm sure, if they were to make that call. But, you know, on the individual level, when we're talking about feeding our families, I think that that's where we have this cultural impact that is so important. You know, we're not going to change policy. We're not going to change the institutions unless, you know, we're having these smaller conversations with our friends and with our families about what we eat, the impact that it has, how we can try as individual people and smaller communities to, you know, do better in terms of our environmental impact when we're sitting down to eat. And you know, also taking into account those workers who aren't the ones benefiting from big governmental subsidies. You know, the workers tend to be undocumented. They weren't eligible to get unemployment when the pandemic hit. They were forced back to work, you know? And so we have to think about all of these things and, you know, no one is ever going to be perfect, but when we have those conversations on the smaller scale, I think that that's how we start to see bigger change incrementally.
Let's talk about our actual plate. So for so many Americans who are brought up with a particular, you know, the meat is the biggest part, and then there's a little starch and maybe a little starchy vegetable right next to it. Yeah. What does a plate look like that isn't that?
Yeah, well, for me, this is such a hard question because I've stopped eating meat 10 years ago. And so I don't remember even what it was like a little to center my plate around meat. But, you know, it's centering beans, legumes, where there's so much variety, so much diversity in those, that kind of a family of proteins. You know, we have tofu, we have tempeh, we have seitan. There's just so much abundance in mushrooms as well for creating meaty dishes. There are proteins that are plant-based. It does take a little more work though to get them to the plate. You know, you can throw a steak in a cast iron pan with a little salt and that will be delicious. But when you're talking about beans, it does mean you need to like get a little more creative. You have to use citrus and herbs and you know, figure out how you're going to make those delicious. But in the end, it's worth it. It's better for our health to at least cut back a little bit on meat and replace that with legumes. And so I think that it's just about kind of finding that groove with replacing proteins that are animal based, you know, just a few times a week and figuring out that you can eat really deliciously without it. That's why I think Meatless Monday is something important. And those days where you don't eat meat are important because they're how you kind of figure out that, hey, I'm not starving and I'm not, you know, miserable and grouchy just because I ate beans instead of chicken. You know, I think that's a really important thing to learn.
Thank you so much, Alicia Kennedy, food writer and author of the newsletter From the Desk of Alicia Kennedy.
Thank you so much for having me.
Summer has not even officially gotten underway yet, but dozens of cities across the country are already seeing record high temperatures for early June. And in California, officials are scrambling in response to the dry conditions that have pushed 93% of California and the Southwest into drought this year. In April and May, California Governor Gavin Newsom announced emergency drought declarations for 41 of his state's 58 counties. Here he is speaking about recent conditions on May 10th.
Let me just talk about the last 3+ weeks. In the last few weeks, we've lost roughly 500,000 acre feet of runoff compared to what we had anticipated, which put into language that I hope people can understand is the equivalent of 1 million households receiving water for a year. That's just in the last number of weeks in the state of California.
California was previously in a drought from 2012 to 2016, and some experts believe the drought never truly ended for the state. The people who are likely to be hardest hit by the current water crisis are the same ones who were most negatively affected the last time around: Latino farm workers living in rural areas. A report issued this year by California's nonpartisan legislative analyst office notes that many of these communities lost access to safe drinking water during the last drought. They also lost out on work when low water supplies made it harder to grow crops.
For more, I'm joined now by Gabrielle Cannon, a reporter covering fires, droughts, and the American West for The Guardian. Thank you for being here, Gabrielle.
Wonderful to be with you.
So maybe we can just start with this. What is it that constitutes drought?
Sure. Yeah. So it's sort of a creeping trend, right? So we'll see these dry conditions. And then once that starts to really impact systems, starts to impact people, starts to impact ecosystems, that's where these drought declarations start to come into play.
Now, what are some of the conditions that led up to this particular drought that so much of California is currently in?
Sure. Yeah. So it's a combination of things. Some bad luck and certainly climate change. I think one of the biggest is these rising temperatures that you mentioned. So what that does is it diminishes the snowpack. It makes it so it's actually less snow and more rain. And then it literally bakes moisture out of the environment. So even when you have these wet years, you really retain a lot less of the water. What we're seeing this year is the snowpack diminished incredibly quickly. Now we're pretty much at zero.
So there was this moment early on during the pandemic when we were getting what felt like good environmental news from around the world, as though all of the humans staying at home was actually improving conditions. And yet that doesn't seem to be where we are now.
Yeah, I mean, it's unfortunately true, right? We're seeing these record high, you know, numbers that are really scary. And with the drought, I think it's something that's, again, something that's kind of been long-term. It's been something that this climate is prone to dry conditions. California, of course, is definitely not new to drought, but climate change is going to make these things a lot worse.
Now, California isn't is certainly no stranger to drought, but we aren't in the hottest months of the year yet. So mm-hmm. what are California's water supply systems looking like right now?
Ooh, it's looking rough. I mean, across the state, you're seeing these reservoirs with just these big bathtub rings. They're incredibly low. I mean, overall, the water supply is less than half of what it normally would be. So some of our biggest reservoirs are much lower than that even. I mean, you've seen areas where boats have had to be removed. And Gavin Newsom himself did a press conference from the dusty footprint of what used to be an important reservoir and lake. So yeah, it's looking really, really grim. But that being said, we don't know what's going to happen this winter.
What might happen that could make some of these conditions more bearable?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, if we get a wet year, if we get another wet winter, certainly we're going to be in better shape. I think one of the things that is important to consider, of course, is like I said, with these rising temperatures, what's really going to be important, though, is that snowpack. So if that snowpack can't recover, it puts a lot more pressure on the systems. That's the best way that California can reserve its water, right? You get this lovely snow that melts into the reservoirs, into the streams, into the creeks. And so there's two things that happens there. First, starting out with less of it is a problem. And then, of course, if the runoff isn't usable, right, it melts into the ground. So we're seeing that happen. Both of those things happen this year. Researchers are hopeful that this will be something that isn't as long term. But of course, it's hard to know for sure.
Latino farm workers are hit hardest, at least certainly were in the last drought. So how proactive is the state being to help those communities this time around?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think it's still incredibly worrisome. I think there are areas in California that still haven't recovered from that. You know, more than a million people in the state don't have access to clean drinking water. It's incredibly horrifying to hear about, right? But Newsom has tried to invest in this particular problem. Part of his new budget is budgeted to increase infrastructure and to try to get water into the areas that may have scarcity issues. And then there's also, you know, long-term plans to try to mitigate some of the things that led to those scarcity issues. So one of the biggest changes is going to be this is a Groundwater Management Act that was passed in 2014. So it's been in play for a little while. The problem is that the way that it works is it asks communities to come up with their own resilience plans and reduction plans for pumping out that groundwater. And so what that is, it's of course the water that's sort of the reserves, right? A lot of communities use it for wells. And when farmers and ranchers and growers don't get the water that they need, they often turn to that to pump it right out of the ground. And last drought, you know, you see like the ground just sinks dramatically. And so the Groundwater Management Act is going to require these communities to stop pumping that groundwater at levels that is not sustainable. But a lot of that isn't really going to be implemented until, you know, a few years down the line, even just the last years when these communities were submitting their plans and proposals.
So it seems to me that asking local communities to come up with their own plans, I see the reasons that could be empowering. I could see why that would make sense, given the idea that communities are quite different from one another. But it also seems to me that environmental management is kind of the classic collective action problem. It actually needs more centralized decision-making. Do we see any more centralized decision-making, not only in California, but maybe nationally to address an issue like this?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there has been a lot of work here. I mean, it's certainly not in the place a lot of folks would like to see it, right? But again, this is one of those issues that's incredibly complicated. There's so many different groups and even ecosystems that rely on this really scarce water. And so distributing it is something that's that's become, it's created a lot of tension. And I think that that's something that, like you said, there needs to be more direction. There needs to be more discussion around how to equitably distribute that essential resource.
Now, the other disaster that we talked so much about last year in California was wildfire season and the horrifying and destructive wildfires we saw last year. What did these current drought conditions mean for the upcoming wildfire season?
Yeah, that's, it's getting scary, right? We're seeing incredibly low moisture in the fuel content. That's vegetation. Of course, drought leads to dead trees. It leads to, parched land. So any of that is going to make fires a lot riskier. And as you said, we've had these record-breaking fire years. Last year, it was 4.1 million acres. I think officials are getting ready. Communities are trying to be prepared. But it's going to be really high risk for the next, all through the end of the year, I would say.
All right. So let's say I don't live in California, and I'll say I don't. I do have a daughter who's in college in California, which is part of why I was watching wildfires so closely. But if I don't live in California, tell me why I should care about droughts and wildfires in a state where I don't live.
Absolutely. So the first thing you to take away is of course, California is one of the biggest breadbaskets of the country. There's a third of the vegetables, two-thirds of fruits and nuts are grown here. So agriculture is an important aspect of our economy, and that's going to be impacted by all of this. The other thing is this is drought, and then, of course, when you layer wildfires on top of that, it's one of the most expensive disasters classified by the federal government. And that's, of course, going to tap resources. So as climate change gets worse, there are going to be more disasters everywhere, right? More natural disasters. We're going to see worsening weather patterns. We're going to see, hurricanes, all these things that are going to be impacting people across the country. And resources are going to be tight. So I think there's been examples in the past when, you have federal resources being invested into helping folks who are in these disaster areas during fire season. And then once that kind of turns over into hurricanes or tornadoes or any of these other issues that are going to happen at the same time, that's really going to put a damper on the federal government's ability to handle some of these huge catastrophes.
Gabrielle Cannon is the reporter covering fires, drought, and the American West for The Guardian. Gabrielle, thank you so much for being here and helping us to see how all of these questions are deeply connected.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, y'all, that's the show. Always a pleasure being here with you, and I hope you enjoy listening. Now, if you missed anything or you want to listen back to any of the old shows, check out our podcast. You can find it wherever you find our podcasts or head on over to takeaway.org. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, in for Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway. See you tomorrow.